Luke 4 at the back is our live stream tech today, and he's, guess what his favorite gospel is? And guess what favorite gospel is mine? It may not be Mark, but I actually really do like Mark. Luke likes Luke. There might be a John in here someplace that likes John. And Matthew loves Matthew. Who knows, right? When a historian looks at the life of Jesus, they can infer many things about it. And there are numerous books, like thousands, tens of thousands of books about the life of Jesus. And it's because we have many sources about Jesus, surprisingly. And we have many sources about the world that he lived in back in the first century. Over the last 50 years, our knowledge of first century Judea has expanded multiple times. And so we have a real insight, a knowledge about the world that Jesus lived in. And that tells us something about him as well. Now, historians don't have a problem also working with gospels or religious texts. They do that all the time. Most ancient documents are religious texts. It's common practice for them to work with religious texts. What's interesting, though, is that in a historical reconstruction of Jesus, it ends at the cross. Pretty much every Jesus scholar, every scholar of the ancient world agrees that that Jesus was crucified by the Romans sometime in the early 30s. 30 being the most common date chosen, 33 being the second most common date chosen. After the point of crucifixion, things get a bit tricky, historically speaking. For instance, some historians claim that Jesus' body would have been thrown into a mass grave after he died, because that was the common Roman practice. That's what Romans typically did with crucified dead bodies. They threw them into common graves. And that would mean that the whole tradition around Jesus being buried in a tomb was fictitious. But here's an example of how our knowledge of the first century world in Judea that Jesus lived in informs us about practices like the burial of bodies who had died through crucifixion. Because it's true that Romans typically dumped bodies, dead bodies from crucifixion into mass graves, but because in Judea where the Jews lived, and in Jewish thinking the body being so important, Judea was the one exception in all the ancient world that Rome ruled where bodies who had died through crucifixion were handed over for burial. And we have recently discovered several examples from the time of Jesus, of crucified remains in Jewish tombs. And I think today the majority of historians who studied the ancient world would accept the gospel account that Jesus was buried in a tomb after his death on a cross, because there's this good, solid historical case for it. And so the historical reconstruction of gets us from the cross now into the tomb. We can make a historical study of Jesus right up until his body gets into the tomb. And that's where the historical story ends. That's where the historical reconstruction ends, at the tomb. But what about what comes next? What do you think? If you're in agreement with the vast majority of historians that we can trace Jesus' story up to his crucifixion, then burial in a tomb, what do you think happened over those 3 days? Because you're not going to get any help from the historians. The historians can pick up the Jesus story, the Christian story, pretty quickly on after the resurrection. Because there's definitely a post-death Jesus community that continued on. We have living proof of that. We are living proof of that. Think about that for a second. Trillium is a living expression of the continuation of a Jesus community post his death. In fact, we could probably make a reconstruction of our history as a church right back almost to the very beginning. We'd go through the three amalgamating congregations that made up Trillium: St. Paul, St. Andrew, Zion. We could go back to the original Methodist congregations in this area: Zion Methodist Church, Preston Methodist Church. They would lead us back to John Wesley and the origins of Methodism, and that would lead us back into the Anglican Church, right back to the 16th century Reformation in England that came out of the Reformation started by Martin Luther back in Germany during the 1520s, 1530s. And if we keep going back, we could trace our lineage to the Roman Catholic Church. And then we could even go before there was such a thing as the Roman Catholic Church, back to the Orthodox Holy Catholic Church of the ancient world. In fact, we could probably trace our lineage right back to the first century. Think about that. We can trace Trillium's lineage back to the first century if we really put our hearts into figuring out where we came from. We could build a kind of family tree for ourselves that would go back to the first century. Historians today feel they can get back, not to the first century, they can get back to within 2 years of Jesus' crucifixion. Historians say that. Not believers. Historians say you can get back to about 2 years after Jesus' death. We have simple creeds and songs of the earliest church embedded in the New Testament from this time. In fact, the historian J.D. Dunn believes that a few of those creeds get us back to within 6 months of Jesus' crucifixion. That means, historically speaking, there was a Jesus community only at least no later than 6 months after Jesus' death on a cross. And so when we go back, that's where the trail ends. So we get up to the tomb, and we can go back along the trail, historically speaking, to about 6 months after his crucifixion, but we've got a bit of gap of time in there. And what are we going to do with that bit of time we have? There's a little black box we can't see into. An event horizon we can't get historically speaking, over. Yet something happened in that little black box on the other side of the horizon that we just can't see it over. Something caused a powerful explosion of life and faith. We know there was an incredible explosion of life and faith. The historical record is clear about that. But what caused it? And it seems to me that we could come up with several possible explanations for what we think happened on the other side of the hill. But I think the simplest approach, the best approach, is to start with what the earliest church said happened. And we see what happened from their point of view in those earliest creeds. And we see it in Paul's letters, and we see it in the Gospels as well. See, those earliest creeds, what Paul wrote in his letters, the Gospels, they all tell us one common thing, that an explosion of life and faith came about because of the resurrection of Jesus. That is their explanation of what happened. That's their explanation of why there is a Jesus community that continued on after his death and burial. And by resurrection, the gospel writers mean a physical, embodied return. That's what the word resurrection means. Anistemi, it literally means to be knocked down and knocked over and then to stand back up again. That's anistemi, to stand back up again, to get back up on your feet. All of you have had moments of anistemi in your life where you've fallen down or you've been knocked over and then you've stood up again. That's anistemi, to get back up on your feet. It's a very simple concept. It's not complicated. You're down and now you're up. And of course, the ultimate anistemi experience is resurrection. The resurrection of the body, because it's the ultimate knockdown. Death is the ultimate knockdown. The ultimate standing again is standing on your feet from death. This is what anistemi means in the New Testament, standing up again from death. Jesus standing before the disciples. And it's so tempting, you know, today for me to move on from this, because it's Easter. I'd love to talk to you about the implications of what it means for Jesus to stand again, stand up on his feet again from death, to talk to you about what resurrection could mean for you or for me. Personally, I'd love to do a little theological exposition on his resurrection. But I'm thinking that many of you aren't quite there yet. Even if you've gone to church your whole life, it's possible that you're not quite there yet when it comes to his resurrection. That's why I really love a program like Alpha. I think Alpha is so critical because it really focuses our attention on what do we really believe. And specifically, there's one whole program on what do you really believe about the resurrection? What do you believe about it, really? And is there something holding you back from completely embracing it for your life? Because if Jesus really did stand again after death, before the disciples, then something a most amazing, an almost explosive thing happened before them that's still resonating in our lives today. And it means the witness of the earliest church that Jesus is alive is true. And I think we need to really ruminate on that and to think, what's our response about the earliest church's witness to Jesus being alive? I'm suspecting, and I could be wrong, I mean, I really could be wrong about this, that there's still a lot of reservations and a lot of you out there about this, about the post-death reality of Jesus. I want to be clear about one thing to you today. I want you to understand one thing. If it's nothing else you understand, it's this. The historical sources make it absolutely clear that the post-death Jesus community exists because they claim that Jesus is alive. That is the testimony of the earliest church. The church itself exists because Jesus is alive. That's why there is a Jesus community at the church after Jesus' crucifixion, because he's alive, raised from the dead in a body. It's not simply they had a vision of Jesus, they met him. And this to me means meeting somebody in a physical way. If Jesus died on a cross and stayed dead, there probably wouldn't have been a Jesus community going forward after his death. Why would there have been? It would make no sense. Jesus was supposedly the Messiah. They all believed that, but now he's dead. And if he stays dead, then in those circumstances, people tend to go home. Or they tend to look for another Messiah to follow. Now, you don't have to believe me. But I would suggest that you cannot deny the historical record that the earliest church, within 2 years at the latest, and maybe within 6 months after Jesus' crucifixion, was saying to the world around them that Jesus was alive. Jesus was dead, and now he's alive. It's really that simple. And where did this idea come from, do you suppose? Did they make it up? Well, maybe. But then how do we explain that explosion of life and faith that rippled out through the first century and then beyond and comes to us even today? Where did that explosion come from? Did it come from a made-up idea? Some fantasy thought on their part? Or is it best explained by the fact that they did meet the risen Lord? As I say, I personally think the simplest and best explanation is that they did meet the risen Lord, raised from the dead. That explains the earliest creeds and the songs, explains the scriptures we get later in Paul and in the Gospels. It explains the explosion of life and faith that went out into that first century world. This all came about at the very beginning of the Christian movement because they met Jesus alive. There's a creed found in 1 Corinthians 15, which is one of the earliest in the New Testament. It says this, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. Gerd Ludemann, an atheist New Testament scholar who is a specialist on the resurrection, says this. Remember, he's an atheist. He doesn't believe that it really happened, but he says this, the elements of the tradition are to be dated to the first 2 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, not later than three. The formation of the appearance traditions mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15 falls into the time between 30 and 33. And it seems to me that if some of us are a bit skeptical about the resurrection of Jesus, it might be part of a bigger issue for us, really. It's not really just about the resurrection. It might be about something to do with God. It might have something to do with our beliefs in God, who we think God is, what we might think God is up to. Because if you believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God, if you believe that there's a governing intelligence behind the universe, if you believe that there's true design in the biological world and in the web of the natural world, if you believe that there's a sense of an ultimate purpose in life, that life has a direction to it, a purpose to it, if you believe that there's such a thing as true, right, and wrong, there's a basic moral frame to the existence of the universe, then it means that you must, at some level, believe in something like a God. And if there is this kind of God out there, then a resurrection from the dead really is no big deal. You know, if there is really a big God out there, then, you know, something like a resurrection from the dead is exactly what I would expect to see, to be honest with you. If there really is a God, I'd expect to see something kind of out of the norm, something that would stretch your understanding of reality. That's what I would expect if there really is that all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God in the background of this existence. You know, among the early Christians, the resurrection was seen as another proof for the existence of God. We tend to look at it the other way around today. We tend to look at it in the reverse. We try to figure out our proofs for God, and if we're satisfied enough, then we might allow something like a resurrection to take place, a resurrection of Jesus, for instance. But the earliest Christians looked at it completely the other way around. They understood the resurrection of Jesus as proof for the existence of God. See, many of them had met the risen Lord. If Jesus is raised from the dead, then there has to be a God. That's how it works for them. If Jesus was raised from the dead, if they're seeing him standing before them, then there has to be a God. And they extrapolated back from resurrection to God. We tend to extrapolate the other way. We go from God to resurrection. As they say, they went the other way. Since Jesus really is alive again, there has to be a governing intelligence behind the universe. Since Jesus really is alive again, there has to be a true design at work in our biological world and a guiding intelligence in the natural web of life. If Jesus is truly alive again, they understood that this meant that there was ultimate purpose to life. Life had a direction to it, what they called a telos, a destination to it. Jesus' resurrection meant there must be an ultimate right or wrong that goes beyond us. Something bigger than us has established right and wrong. We didn't make them up. Otherwise, why would the violence and hatred directed against Jesus be overturned in his raising from the dead? Through the forgiveness and love. The resurrection means that there is a basic moral frame to our existence and to the world we live in. See, Jesus is alive again, and that means that love really is truly, truly greater than hatred. Jesus is alive again, and that means life is greater than death. Jesus is alive again, and that means forgiveness, not revenge, is our way forward with each other in life. Now, this is only true if you believe Jesus is raised from the dead. Do you believe that? I say today that we stop worrying about trying to prove ourselves that God exists and work backwards from the resurrection. We can start with the resurrection of Jesus. We can start there, and we can do that if we trust the witness of the earliest church, that they met the risen Lord. We can take their testimony to heart. They were at ground zero of the whole Christian life that we are now living out 2,000 years later. We have their witness that might have been within only months after the event of Jesus' death and resurrection. Why would we not trust it? Why would you not trust their witness? They have a powerful testimony to share with us. It's found in the New Testament. They believe that Jesus is alive and that there really is an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God at the center of all things. And the response to this is, hallelujah. 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 And we can invite the living presence of Jesus Christ to come into our hearts today, here, now, in this moment, because he's alive. And if he's alive, he's here with us.